Should we get going? Sorry about this slight chaotic like conditions, but at least it shows that people want to come, so it's good for me anyway. So well, can I say welcome to everybody to this series of lectures just on LSE business. Can I wish everyone here a really happy academic year this year at the LSE. For those of you new to the LSE, it's a really great place intellectually, I think, and I would strongly encourage everyone to take advantage of the number of visitors who come and the general lively nature of the intellectual atmosphere. For those of you who've been at the LSE a long while, I hope this year is as good as every other year for you at the school. We'll do our best to make it so. I'll be giving either five or six lectures in this course. I'm not completely sure whether I can fit the sixth one in. The first three, including this one, I'll be giving this term, and the last two or three I'll be giving 1,000 years from now, or in the new millennium after Christmas. So be like three this term and two or three next term. What I'm proposing to do in these lectures is recapitulate, expand, look again at the themes that I discussed in the BBC Reith lectures in April this year. From those of you who don't come from this country, the Reith lectures are a series of lectures given once a year on the BBC. The ones I gave were on BBC Radio 4 and BBC World Service. They've been going about half a century or so. Bertrand Russell was the first Reith lecturer many years ago. The Reith lectures were named after Lord Reith, who was, as it were, the founder of the BBC, so they're kind of traditional thing. They always used to be given simply as broadcast talks in Broadcasting House. But last year, for the first time, last year's Reith lecturer was a historian of war called John Keegan. That was the first time that they had an audience, you know, and they had a dialogue after each lecture with questions and responses. Well, for my ones this year, we did the same thing, but we made another innovation. That is, we went off and gave them at different places around the world. The theme of the Reith lectures, like the theme of these lectures here, was globalization. The unbelievable changes really happening to the world in which we live. So we thought it would be appropriate to zoom around the world and give the lectures in different places. We gave the first one in London, second one in Hong Kong, third one in Delhi in India, fourth one in Washington, and the fifth one in London. Would have been very nice to have given one in Africa, but it didn't work out that way logistically, unfortunately. In each of these cases, we had an invited audience, and each case tried to get, sorry about this microphone, seems to lose power in certain places. In each place, we tried to get questions from a diversity of people in the audience, and we had at least one like superstar each time asking a question. So we had Tony Blair in the first one in London asking a question. In Hong Kong, we had Rosanna Wong, who's on the Hong Kong ruling council. In India, we had a range of really interesting people. First question was asked by Kiran Bedi, who is the head of the Delhi police force. And counterintuitively, at least for me, turns out to be a woman, and very interesting one at that, who used to be apparently a former women's tennis champion. So asked a very good question. In Washington, we had a question from Hillary Clinton. And in the last London one, we had a question from Romano Prodi, who, as I hope you all know, is the incoming president of the European Union, an LSE graduate. He got a PhD at the LSE, and therefore, like everyone who's anyone, you know, really strong connections with the LSE. And we hope Romano will come back and give a lecture at the LSE next term. Hillary Clinton, incidentally, has agreed to come and give a lecture at the school next July about women and civil society. So that should be a good and big occasion for the school. Around the Reith lectures, we also had an internet dialogue. What we did each time before I gave a lecture, we put up questions on a website, global website, and we invited people to respond. And it got us extraordinary response from people all over the world, because what we tried to do was start like a global dialogue about globalization, and that is certainly how it worked out. We got questions from innumerable people in different positions in so many different countries, who then started a kind of dialogue among themselves. So it was a very successful part, I felt, of the whole endeavor. We are continuing that. We transferred the website to the LSE website, and it's possible to interrogate me on that website if you are so inclined. There's something called, like, I don't know, the director's website or something or other like that, which is a continuation of this dialogue. You can easily find it. It isn't at the moment, as I understand it, an interactive website, but it will be pretty shortly. So I'd encourage you to have a look at that if you're interested and see how the dialogue is developing. There is also a book list, or there should be very shortly, a book list for these lectures posted on that website. I thought I'd just put it there rather than bringing you loads of pieces of paper. But as I found out just now, it hasn't been posted yet, but it should be posted between this lecture and the next one. The website, by and large, covers the themes of these lectures, except there's a lot more about the debate on third way politics. If I get a chance in the sixth lecture, since there were five lectures in the Reith lecture series, if I get a chance in the sixth lecture, I might discuss politics, that is, where all these changes lead us, really, if you still want to create a decent society in a world undergoing so much transformation. Well, the starting point of these lectures for me is what I define as a world which has taken us by surprise. It seems to me the world in which we live, the world at the end of the 20th century, only another month and a half to go of the 20th century, amazing, the world in which we live doesn't look like that anticipated by the founders of Enlightenment thought. The founders of Enlightenment were the principal founders of the intellectual traditions which made Western culture and which increasingly have shaped global culture. The founders of Enlightenment had a pretty simple but very powerful precept about the relationship between human knowledge, science, technology, and the external world. What they thought was, the more we can get to understand about the world of nature, and the more we can get to understand about our own lives and our own history, the more we can control nature, and the more we can direct our own history. It's a simple and, I think, persuasive idea. It was the idea which all the Enlightenment philosophers had. Previously, the world has been subject to the whims of irrational forces, of dogma, of tradition. Why don't we try and rationally understand the world? If we rationally understand what the world is like, the external world and our own world, our own history, surely we'll be able to subordinate history to our own purposes. Marx put it in probably the most effective way. Marx said, we have to know our history in order to make history. History has been made in an unconscious way previously. We should look to make history consciously, rationally, through an understanding of the dynamics which move our lives and the dynamics which determine the world of nature around us. The idea then that we could subject the world to greater and greater control is perhaps the dominant idea of the last 200 years, and it's been kind of the driving idea which has pushed Western civilization to become a global civilization. The idea that science tradition are essentially irrational, sorry, that tradition and dogma are essentially irrational, and that science and rational knowledge can and should, in most spheres of life anyway, replace these. Well, as we stand at our vantage point at the end of the 20th century, I'd suggest to you the world doesn't seem or feel like that. If they were right, it would follow that the world would seem to us to be a tightly controlled, highly organized, predictable world. Even the people who didn't like the Enlightenment vision thought that the world would become like that, more tightly controlled. We would all be a little cog in a large machine.
Max Weber, the famous German sociologist at the turn of the century, argued that the world would become more and more a gigantic machine in which we would all be simply little cogs, all knowing our own part, a highly predictable, rational world. George Orwell, the novelist, drew this up as an anti-utopia. He thought that if the dreams of enlightenment would produce a rational world, it might be an oppressive world. And Franz Kafka, the famous novelist as well, also looked on the world as a bureaucratic nightmare, but a rigidly controlled world. That was the kind of dystopia, the opposite of a Marxist utopia. Well, Marxism has collapsed, one of the remarkable things of the 20th century. Marxism was the dominant force of the 20th century until the 1980s. Now it's more or less evaporated into thin air with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the transformation of China. The world doesn't feel like these thinkers anticipated, almost to the contrary. Rather than a world, I think, tightly within our control, a world of high organization and predictability, it feels almost, although of course not completely, like the opposite. A world marked by great uncertainties, where we don't even know really what tomorrow holds. If you look at, for example, the impact of information technology, who can really tell where the next technological breakthrough will take us? Well, nobody can, because technological change is actually not all that predictable. Rather than being a world within our control, it seems to be an erratic, dislocated world in which we live at the end of the century, if you like, a runaway world. That's why I chose the theme, Runaway World, for the lectures. The runaway world is not a world which we give up hope of controlling. It is a world which has introduced new kinds of unpredictability, new kinds of risk, new kinds of uncertainty. And interestingly, some of these uncertainties, they come from the very sources that were supposed to make the world predictable. If you look, for example, at the role of science and technology, I think from our vantage point this far on in the development of modernity, no one would argue that science and technology simply make the world in a linear sense more predictable. Science and technology introduce uncertainties which no one has had to face before, often unintended ones. If you consider the debate over global warming, for example, debate over global warming is debate precisely about the impact of science and technology on the natural world. Global warming debate is riven with uncertainties. Is global warming a reality? What will it do to the world? How should we respond? Once you penetrate this thing, you find that even science itself is much more close to uncertainty than we used to imagine. So in these lectures, I'll be looking into the nature of the runaway world, but I'll also be suggesting that the runaway world needs to be brought back under our dominion. That we can't realize the dreams that Marx and the Enlightenment philosophers had. There is no way that the accumulation of knowledge will allow us simply to colonize the future, to carve out the future as a space which we can just invade and occupy. The very development of knowledge actually makes the future often more opaque rather than less opaque. One of the great findings, really, of the late 20th century, I would say. But this doesn't mean that we should renounce the aim of trying to introduce more regulation and government into a world which needs it. And our world, as I'll be suggesting later on, certainly does need it. It needs more regulation, it needs more control, it needs more human conscious direction. We have to renounce the dream of the Enlightenment philosophers, but we don't have to renounce the idea that we can influence the world, that we can shape it, that it's not just a world of forces that will move us at whim. Now, when you look into the origins of this runaway world, of this uncertain series of possible futures that we face, there's one great set of changes which lies behind these transformations in the recent period, and that is excuse me, the impact of the phenomenon I mentioned earlier, phenomenon of globalization. You can't even be a practicing social scientist of any sophistication if you do not master, if you do not grasp or master the debate about globalization. It is probably the most significant debate now going on in the social sciences, and in politics too, because it has a strong impact on the world of political theory, as well as the world of social science and the academy directly. Now, if you trace the history of the term globalization, it's really interesting, because only about 10 or 12 years ago, hardly anyone used the word. If you look back to the academic literature of the late 1980s, and if you look at the popular press or the writings of politicians, business leaders, not many people actually use the term globalization. If they talked about the phenomenon, they usually talked about the international community, international relations, sometimes internationalization. The term globalization has come from nowhere to be everywhere in a period of something like just a decade. You can't really open a newspaper without seeing the term globalization referred to. You can't certainly hear a speech by a certain Mr. Tony Blair without the term globalization being mentioned, and you can't open the book of any business guru without that term being central. And all you go around, as you go around the world, like I went to Korea, we have a Korean journalist sitting at the front here I was talking to earlier, you go around the world, now the debate about globalization is global. I've been to lots of countries, mainly fundraising for the LSE, you'll be pleased to know, in recent months. And I haven't been to a single one where the notion of globalization is not being intensively debated. This is one of the big changes in one's experience of academic life that reflects the transformations these lectures are about. Only a few years ago, as an academic, if I went around the world, I sometimes felt that's something new to say, you know, that people hadn't heard about. But it's very hard these days because people get the same sources almost immediately. So it doesn't matter whether you're in Beijing or whether you're in Seoul or whether you're in Africa. People get this in the academic world, the same sources almost immediately, usually using electronic technologies, of course. So these things express what the term globalization describes. However, when a word comes from nowhere to be everywhere, not surprising that it's the subject of intense debate, and it is. And this debate counts for an awful lot. The position one takes on the debate about globalization settles a good deal, not only about one's academic views of the world, but also about one's political views as well, for reasons I'll go on to mention. And there is a kind of big split between two views of what's going on in the world today. The best writer on these issues is a political scientist who I'm pleased to say will be joining the LSE within about 9 months' time, called David Held. David Held and his colleagues have written a book called Global Transformations. Global Transformations is the best source of material on the globalization debate. What Held and his colleagues do is to divide the controversy into two opposed positions. On the one hand, there are the people who they call the globalization skeptics. The globalization skeptics are, if you like, people who think there's nothing new under the sun. People who are skeptical of the idea that there are big changes going on in the world and that the world is becoming more integrated than it used to be. They simply hold this idea to be largely false. The globalization skeptics argue that all the talk about globalization is a myth, and that the term globalization has been put into currency, they say, largely by politically motivated authors, especially right-wing authors, who want to use the idea of globalization as a way of saying that we must reduce welfare systems, that we must reduce the protection we offer to workers because everyone has to compete in a global marketplace now. The globalization skeptics argue that if you look back 100 years to the end of the 19th century, you'll find that there was already a global marketplace, there was already a lot of trade in currencies, there was already open borders in the late 19th century. Many countries didn't even have passports, for example, at that time. There was a lot of immigration and emigration and immigration around at that period. So the globalization skeptics say, well, what's new? If you look back to this period, it's more or less the same as now. So at most what's happened is a kind of reversion to the late 19th century. But by and large, the globalization skeptics see continuity. They don't really think there have been big changes in the world over the past 30 or 40 years worth calling by a new and special term, globalization. The best discussion of this, if you're interested, it's a very good book actually, is Paul Hurst and Graham Thompson. That's called Globalization in Question. If anyone's interested in looking at that book, you should look at the second edition. There's a new edition that just came out this year that has updated statistics in it. If you're a globalization skeptic, you tend to be on the old left. You tend to have, I think, a traditional leftist view of the world. Or put it the other way around, many people on the more traditional left are globalization skeptics. The reason for this is that if you believe that not much has changed in the world, if you think that there is a lot of continuity in the world, well then you tend to say, well, the welfare state can simply carry on as it used to do. Nation states still have a lot of power. We can do a lot more in the economy than many other people believe. Basically, you can keep the traditional apparatus of left-wing politics intact. And that indeed is what Paul Hurst and Graham Thompson do think. On the other side, there are those who David Held calls the hyper-globalizers. The hyper-globalizers. The hyper-globalizers take almost the contrary view. Best example of them is the Japanese business writer Kenichi Omai, who's written a number of books, but one is called The Borderless Economy, and another is called The End of the Nation State. The hyper-globalizers argue that not only is globalization real, it is here, it is changing everything, it's transforming the structure of states, it's transforming the nature of economies, it's transforming most of our basic institutions. Omai argues that the era of the nation state is drawing to a close in the face of the intensification of the global marketplace. The dominant feature of our time, Omai says, is the intensified economic interdependence and with that intensified competition that all economies must now enter into on a global level. As the global marketplace expands, and as with it the knowledge economy expands, the information economy expands, simply get a transformation of traditional systems. The nation state is disappearing, he argues. Not only about to disappear, it's already some way through the process of disappearing. Omai argues that in no more than about 30 or so years' time, there may be 100 or so, 200, 300 city-states, which will be largely replacing nation-states. City-states and regional states will become more important, he thinks, because they enter directly into the global economy. Consider, for example, Hong Kong, London, New York, Frankfurt, Barcelona, Bombay, other cities. A lot of their production is for the global marketplace, their orientation is towards the global market. It doesn't really matter to them so much, he argues, what country they're a part of, because what defines their identity is their involvement in the new global electronic economy. Best example, I imagine for him, would be sitting just down the road from here, the City of London. City of London, the financial centre of London, is a globalised, it's part of a globalised economy. There's no real connection, it could be argued, with the rest of the UK economy. And Omai says, as this happens, you get these sort of massive inequalities sitting alongside one another. So I don't know how many people here will have been down to the east of London recently, but if you go down to the east of London, you can see this amazing phenomenon, these high-rise, glitzy buildings that have an edge. And a lot outside the edge, you go to poverty. There are people living with 30-40% unemployment in areas right adjacent to the city, in some of the most dilapidated buildings in London, in the East End. And Omai would say, well, that's because you're dealing with two economies here. One is a local economy struggling along. The other is a glitzy, globalized economy integrated into the world system. So for writers like Omai, the most significant feature of our age is a break with the past. Omai argues that it's only about over the last 30 or so years that you have this enormous intensification of globalizing processes. Well, who is right in this debate? I have to say that in my view, the answer is closer to the second group than the first. That is, in my view, the hyper-globalizers, although those who argue that there are really radical changes going on in the world, and they are somehow involved with that phenomenon we call globalization, this is much nearer to the truth than the idea that not much is changing and that all is continuity. You'll never resolve these issues because there will always be people who feel more continuity than change, but I think it is demonstrable that there are fundamental changes going on in the global economy. How do you demonstrate it? Well, you demonstrate it most easily with reference to world financial markets. If you start first with trade in commodities, trade in material goods, Held and his colleagues actually show the level of world trade in physical commodities is much higher than it was 100 years ago and much higher than it was 30 or 40 years ago. So there is a globalization even of trade in physical commodities. If you look at services, that trade is even more intense. There's a massive growth in trading of services. But if you look at the financial economy, that's where the developments are most intense. That's where, to me, it's impossible to resist the conclusion that there are new economic forces abroad in the world. Even over the last 10 to 15 years, been a massive acceleration of the amount of currency dealings and financial dealings going on across the world. And these dealings take place more or less on a 24-hour basis. The volume of money circulating around the world is something like 100 times higher now than it was 15 years ago, which is quite extraordinary statistic. There are many ways of measuring it. I think, therefore, it's really very difficult to deny the idea that there are radical changes going on in the global economy. These are bound up also with the advent of a knowledge economy, because as the world economy expands, it's becoming what Danny Quar, again at the LSE, I'm trying to get in all these local references, you will notice. Danny Quar, economist in the LSE, calls the weightless economy. The weightless economy means that increasingly economic value on a global level depends upon the trading of information rather than the trading of material goods. The whole of the financial economy is a weightless economy, but many other aspects of production, and especially the trading of services, are now weightless. They depend upon information which you trade and exchange, not upon the manufacture of material goods. He calls it the weightless economy because he says, you look back 30 or so years, if you're able to actually weigh the volume of goods traded across the world 30 years ago, and you weighed them physically with the volume of physical commodity trade now, there wouldn't be any difference. It stayed about the same. The total weight of the goods traded would be about the same. But the actual value of the world economy over that period has gone up by a factor of about 5 times. And nearly all that added value has come from the trading of information, not from the trading of material goods. So you're dealing with an information economy, what another writer calls living on thin air, the weightless economy, the electronic economy, there are many terms for it. But it itself has become globalized, and currency markets especially are the purest form, really, of the new weightless economy. So I side with the radicals or the hyperglobalizers, but I think they're quite wrong in some of the conclusions they draw and some of the ways in which both sides, both the skeptics and the hyperglobalizers or the radicals, portray the arguments. I'd like to propose to you that it's a basic mistake to treat globalization as solely or even primarily economic. The economic marketplace is certainly one of the driving agencies of intensifying globalization. But globalization is not primarily economic in and of itself. Globalization, I think, refers to a set of changes, not a single dimension of change. Many of these changes are social, cultural, and political, rather than purely economic. And one of the main drivers, in addition to the global marketplace, is something partly separable from it, which is the communications revolution. I think if you go back to the late 1960s, that's the time at which the revolution in electronic communications started to transform both the ways in which we're able to relate to one another across the world and also the inner content of economic systems. I say the late 1960s because that was the first time at which a satellite system was sent up above the Earth. It was first of all a non-commercial satellite system. Commercial satellite systems date from the early 1970s. Once you have a network of communication satellites in place, it means you can communicate from any part of the Earth to any other. At least in principle, instantaneous global communication is possible. To me, this has changed an enormous amount about world society. And as I'll be saying in a minute, it's also changed a great deal about our personal lives too. It's changed a lot in the world society because when you have instantaneous communication in which television and other electronic media are the leading agencies, it invades the texture of our experience. It changes aspects of sovereignty and politics, and these are very visible. I think it's not too much to say that the decline and the fall of the Soviet Union was bound up with these transformations. The Soviet Union was able to survive pretty well in the old industrial world, and it built itself on hard industry. Factories with big chimneys, heavy industry, was the core of the Soviet Union, really. It kept up with the West pretty well in terms of growth rates until the early 1970s. Soviet Union started to fall behind after that period. Fell behind because it could not compete in the new global electronic economy, and because its system of power, authoritarian top-down power, is not compatible with the softer forms of power which function more effectively in a globalized communication system. So I think it's not surprising that television played a major role in the East, the revolutions in Eastern Europe, which we commemorated yesterday. This is a very apposite time to give this lecture, really is, because it's only a day after the 10th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. The fall of the Berlin Wall, or a couple of days, the fall of the Berlin Wall would not have happened, I think, and it wouldn't have had the kind of domino effect it had without the influence of television. The influence of television has been very demonstrable in this. I don't think the ending of apartheid in South Africa, which also happened largely without violence, would not have happened without the prior occurrence of these events in Eastern Europe. The same thing almost happened in China in Tiananmen Square, except there the authorities reacted pretty differently. I think in a globally mediated world, the structures of our experience are different from the past. And I actually, when I gave the last Reith lecture in London, I told this little story about this. It was a true story because I happened to be in Berlin, actually, at the time when the Berlin Wall came down. No one knew it was going to happen. I was at a conference there, very close to the wall, you know. And there were a few people at the conference who came from the east side of Berlin. And they disappeared from the conference in the afternoon. They came back and they told us the Berlin Wall was going to be opened. So we all got down there, and we were about the first people, I think, to get to the wall, more or less. And we started to try and climb up these ladders that people put up against the wall. And these TV crews appeared and pushed us down. So, and they said, we've got to be on top first, because we've got to film you making history. So to me, it showed something about the media, really, the significance of media in these events. And I don't know if anyone here has been involved in sort of major historical events or even major events in your lives, but there's an odd thing about it because they have a kind of unreality to them. I mean, we're standing at Checkpoint Charlie and all these little Trabant cars, you know, were coming through from Eastern Europe and people were pouring champagne over them, literally. People were coming through these maps and the map had a hole where West Berlin was, because if you were in East Germany, you weren't even allowed to have a map of the West. But you stood there in this event and you got this feeling, well, is this really happening? You know, standing on top of the Berlin Wall where you would have been shot off a day ago, had this odd feeling. And maybe this is what television does to us, because in a world sort of increasingly dominated by televisual means, real experiences, like when someone dies or you go to a funeral, they often have this vague sense of unreality which is somehow hard to cope with, hard to enjoy. Also, this other thing happened that stayed in my consciousness a long time, which was the day before the Berlin Wall was opened. I went through in the normal way, which is a pretty horrendous procedure if you're a Westerner. And the guards there, they were so brutal looking, you know, the East German guards. And you knew these were people who'd shot people who were trying to get from the East to the West. Well, we went back the next day through the wall, sort of when it had been opened a couple of days later rather than one day later. And those same guards were there and they were all smiling and normal. They were just like ordinary people. And ever since then, I wondered which was the true person, because it was as if a complete change of personality had occurred somehow. Gives you some indication of the sort of relationship between psychological feelings, identity, and these grand historic events. Anyway, globalization to me is about a transformation of our basic institutions. It's not simply economic, it's not just dominated by economic forces, it's much more closely connected with communication. It affects the state, it affects nations, it affects our personal lives. But for me, you have to understand globalization as like a threefold prism or a threefold figure. Globalization, especially the global marketplace, takes certain powers away from the nation. We know this happens. Nations are not as much in command of their economic futures as they used to be. On the other hand, globalization has an opposite connotation and force. Globalization pushes down. As it pushes down, it creates new possibilities for and motivations for local cultural autonomy and local identity. So it has if you sort of represent it visually, it has like a pushes upwards, but also pushes downwards. And the push down effect of globalization is the reason for the revival of local nationalisms, local forms of cultural identity, and even, as I'll go on to argue in a subsequent lecture, for the kinds of events which happened in ex-Yugoslavia and in other areas of the world. You can't see those as just an historical relationship to the Balkans. You have to see them as related to the fragmented downward impact of globalization. Globalization, however, also pushes sideways. It does what Omai says it does. Globalization creates new social, cultural, economic areas that sometimes cross-cut the boundaries of nations. An area like that is the area around Catalonia, Barcelona in northern Spain, which overlaps with southern France, is also part of the European Union, yet at the same time is linked to the Spanish economy. So globalization is a complex set of partly contradictory forces. It's very important, I think, to understand that it's not a single force pulling in a single direction. Moreover, I would want to argue anyway, globalization is not just about out there phenomena. It's not just about the big systems. It's not just about the global marketplace. It's not just about processes affecting states. It's an in here phenomenon too. Our lives, our personalities, our identities, our emotions, our relationships with other people, these are being reshaped by globalizing processes. Because what globalization does is it kind of invades local culture, it invades local contexts of life, and it forces us to live in a more open, reflexive, and individualized way. Going along with globalization, there is the impact of individualization. Individualization is the personal pole at which there is the other pole of the globalization of large institutions. Individualization, I should hasten to say, does not mean selfishness, or not intrinsically. Individualization means being forced to live a more reflective life towards an open future. I'll say more about this in subsequent lectures, but more and more tradition and custom are declining in their impact on our lives. Even in the more traditional cultures, this is true. As they do so, you face much of an open future. Facing an open future means actually creating a self-identity rather than simply taking a self-identity from a cultural background or a traditional form of history. This is a process which is liberating. It has many emancipatory consequences, but it's also frightening. Personally, I think women are caught up in this this paradox and this puzzle most forcefully of all, because these changes are affecting women's lives and are affecting women's lives very radically. Where to be a woman used to mean to have a domestic life, to have children, to be largely subordinate in a male-dominated universe, still means many of these things, but they've become radically changed. So you're much freer if you're a woman in a Western country than women were a generation ago. But what do you do with that freedom? How do you live? How should you look? How should you relate to other people? What do you make of marriage? You know, you have first time ever, I think, a situation where many women in Western countries say they do not want to have children. 25% of women under 30 in EU countries say seriously they do not intend to have children. The birth rate in some EU countries is down to about 1.1, 1.2, which is literally the lowest birth rate ever known in any society in human history. Women have to make sense of all these things, and of course, as they do so, the position of men starts to change very radically too, and we see this having a big effect, especially on younger men in Western countries, especially connected with unemployment and other changes that I'll discuss later on. Globalization, therefore, in sum, is really about the changing influence of space and time in our lives. With the advent of the communications revolution, distance has a different relationship to self, immediacy, and experience than it used to do. Distance isn't simply wiped out, but when you have a world where the value of the money in your pocket is affected immediately by ongoing electronic transactions happening many miles away from you, it's simply a different situation from how the world was in the past. Now, there are two big questions that I have to briefly ask and answer in concluding this first lecture. First, what is the impact of these changes on the nation state? Is Omai right to assert that nations are no longer important? And with that, he couples that assertion to the idea that political power is no longer significant, that governments don't matter much anymore because they can't really affect the shape of the world. That's one question, really two questions in one, if you like. Second question is globalization the same as westernization? Does globalization really mark the increasing, ever-expanding tendency of Western countries, Western economies, and Western capitalism to dominate the rest of the world? Two big questions, which I'll only give you what I take to be an orientation towards in the last 5 minutes of the lecture, but which I'll be coming back to regularly at other points in the subsequent lectures. First of all, the nation state. I think it's plain that writers who argue that nation state is disappearing are wrong. The nation state is still a vital power in the world. Some ways you could say that in the global era, the nation state is even more important rather than less important as compared to the past. The reason I say this is that until very recently, other alternatives to the nation state existed. For example, the Soviet Union was a kind of empire, was a kind of imperial system. Empires have existed various points in the 20th century prior to the present time. All formal empires, with the possible exception of the American Empire, if you want to call it that, have disappeared from the world. All nations have become nation states, so that's a pretty big transformation. So you could say this is the first time in which the nation state has actually become pretty near universal form, because so far as I know, only the South Pole would, or the two poles would be exceptions to this, but even those are to some extent claimed, and even parts of space actually are claimed by nations and have notional borders. So you couldn't say the nation state is disappearing in this sense. Moreover, nation states, to my mind, still remain much more important than their chief power rivals in the global system, which is the large corporations. Now, these gigantic corporations that everyone knows about. Exxon is one of the biggest, for example, in the world. Well, its revenue over the year is larger than all but about 9 or 10 nations in the world. So you're talking about gigantic globalized enterprises. However, it seems to me that big companies are not as powerful as nations, certainly as the larger nations. The reasons are that nations still have territory, whereas companies don't. Nations still have access to military power and control of the means of violence, where, as corporations, if they ever do, only do so very obliquely. And nations still are largely responsible for establishing frameworks of law, and those frameworks of law can pretty substantially affect what corporations can do in the world. So I think you have to conclude that nation states are still very important. You have to conclude also that, therefore, political power is still important. Well, that's not just a therefore, but political power is still important. The political leadership of a nation is still important. I would like to try and substantiate the claim later in the lectures that government has a bigger role to play in a globalized world, not a lesser role, as so many people think. But a good deal of that government can't be just national anymore. So although nations remain important, I think you have to say the sovereignty of nations is shifting, the makeup of nation states is changing, and nation states are being forced to reinvent their identities. You consider what's happening in the UK, a process of devolution, which is partly a response to globalizing influences. It's not just an accidental thing that the Scots want more independence. It conforms to globalizing influences. The UK has to reinvent its identity against the backdrop of all these changes. So you're really talking about a continued role for the nation state, less power in some areas, perhaps more power in others, but certainly changing structures of sovereignty. The Pinochet case, the intervention in Kosovo, and other changes in the global order are putting into question the absolute nature of state sovereignties. And this is absolutely right and proper, at least in my view. Secondly, is it all a Western plot? Is the expansion of globalization simply an expansion of Western power, which is corrupting, destroying traditional cultures, enforcing the dominance of the West over the rest? Well, briefly put, you certainly have to recognize that globalization is dominated by Western powers. Most of the big corporations are located in the West. The United States is still, or has become, easily the dominant superpower. That the United States is in a position to shape the world economy according to its own interests. All those things, I think, have to be accepted. The world system is heavily skewed in power towards the West. Within the West, the United States is the dominant economic, political, and military power. That having been said, I think it is quite false to draw from that conclusion that globalization is simply a Western phenomenon. That is absolutely, I think, false. Globalization is much more complicated, much more decentered, much less within our control, if you like, than such a view would suggest. Globalization affects every country in the West just as much as every other country in the world. And globalization, as I'll try to show in later lectures, has many positive benefits to offer. It is a mistake to suppose that globalization is at the origins of increasing economic inequalities in the world. It is a mistake to suppose that a kind of protectionist opting out of globalization processes would help the poorer countries. The key question for us in addressing global inequalities, as we must, is to try to get globalizing processes within our control and focus them upon human needs. This is something we can do. And I'll be trying to show why and how in subsequent lectures. Let me thank you all for this one, and I hope that some people will also return for the next one next Wednesday at the same time. Thanks very much indeed.